This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. I spent the first morning of 2019 binge-watching old episodes of an 80s sitcom. It was a show that had it all. A theme song sung by Alan Thicke. A precocious child star.
What you talking about, Willis?
And a laugh track. Why did I start my year out with this trip down memory lane? I blame this guy.
Ah, I'm Marcellus Vernon Wiley.
These days, Marcellus Wiley is a host for Speak for Yourself on Fox Sports. But back in the 80s, he was just a kid growing up in Compton and South Central LA.
Before it became a song or an album or before it became a movie, it was just life or death. I had uncles who used to be gang members, and I saw how they were respected and feared in the streets. But then I saw them come in the house, and I saw the tears, and I saw the weakness. They didn't know how this was going to end, and unfortunately, two were murdered and one committed suicide.
Marcellus didn't want that life, but to avoid it, he had to know what not to wear, what not to say, what streets to avoid.
I just hated that. To know those things was going to help me survive, but it wasn't going to help me thrive in life. I wasn't going to leave the neighborhood and set up my family and get generational wealth by knowing what does a Raider hat really mean in the hood.
The idea that there was a different life outside the hood, that there was such a thing as generational wealth, Marcellus learned about that by watching TV.
My favorite was Different Strokes.
I've never seen a black goldfish before.
That's okay. He never saw a rich white man before either.
That told me a lot. It told me that, wow, there is a better place. There is a different place.
For eight seasons, starting in 1978, Different Strokes followed the lives of two orphan boys from Harlem who were adopted by their mother's former employer.
I'm going to see that you had the same advantages that I had growing up. You're going to go to the best schools, the finest colleges.
But I didn't see the path that connected to me. Like, I didn't see how affluence was going to be attained by me.
There was one feature of the family's penthouse in Manhattan that really stuck out for Marcellus, the circular staircase in the kitchen.
And I always told myself, when I make it, if I make it, I'm going to get me a circular stairwell. It was just the thing that I wanted.
Marcellus knew there was no rich white man coming to adopt him. He'd have to find a way to take himself and his family out of the hood. Luckily, when he was eight, Marcellus found football. And just like schoolwork, it was something that came naturally.
You give me the ball, I was just going to run circles around every other 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14-year-old, scoring 4 or 5 touchdowns a game. It was simple.
Marcellus knew that a career in the NFL could get him to where he wanted to go. But first, he had to get to college. Marcellus started at Westchester High, a public school with a great football program. He hoped that would be enough to attract the attention of college scouts. But by the end of his sophomore year, he had doubts.
A lot of people were underachieving based on how good they were. All-state, all-American players, but going to community colleges. And I just was like, that can't be me. I was too responsible for my family in terms of getting us out the neighborhood. So I just couldn't underachieve.
So Marcellus transferred to a private school, St. Monica's in Santa Monica. To get there every day, he'd catch a ride with his mother, who worked at the post office. She'd drop him off at the front gate by 5:47 every morning so that she could get to work by 6. Marcellus would set himself up near the stairs by the gym. He'd sprawl out on an old sleeping bag to finish his homework.
Your thoughts wander to good places when you're on campus, but you're not with your peers. You're not with your classmates. You're not with your teammates. You're just kind of thinking, like, what's next in life?
But Marcellus's plan hit some snags. First, there were his knees. He was in constant pain. Then the coach that had recruited Marcellus to come to St. Monica's left for another school and took most of the team with him. Marcellus thought about leaving too, but his mother wouldn't hear of it.
She was like, you're not going to 3 high schools in 4 years. You're not that kid. And she was right.
So Marcellus stayed at St. Monica's for his senior year.
And it was pretty disturbing because we were sorry as hell. We were the worst team. We were 0-10 on the field. Not the best way to get recruited, but it all worked out.
It worked out, in part because of all those long mornings Marcellus spent sprawled out on that sleeping bag by the stairs to the gym. He went from being a good student to being a very good student, one good enough to get recruited by a university not too far from that Manhattan penthouse on TV.
The first time I heard of it, I actually saw it. It was on my coach's shorts. I just noticed the colors at first. I was like, "Coach, what's Columbia?" And he's like, "Oh, that's where I went to college." I was like, "Yeah?" He's like, "Yeah, it's an Ivy League school back east."
At the time, Ivy League only meant one thing to Marcellus Wiley. Those were the schools on the sweaters worn by Bill Cosby on The Cosby Show.
So I was like, "Oh, so it's like Harvard, Yale, Princeton." He was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Trust me, it's the worst football program in the country. Don't even think about going there. But it's an amazing school."
Only a year earlier, Columbia University had finally broken the streak, the longest losing streak in NCAA Division I history, 44 losses in a row. Marcellus was being recruited by UCLA and Cal Berkeley, but he found himself drawn to Columbia. If his NFL dreams didn't work out, he knew a degree from an Ivy would open a lot of doors. So in the summer of 1992, Marcellus Wiley went to Columbia. But the Marcellus who left LA wasn't the same as the one who arrived in New York.
So in the hood, I was the nerd. I was the MVP. I was the nice dude. I get to Columbia, I'm the big, bad black dude from Compton that just plays football. And I was like, whoa, that was a switch. I'm no different, but the backdrop changed.
Just as Marcellus had been introduced to life in a Manhattan penthouse through TV, his classmates, some of whom arrived on campus via helicopter, had been introduced to life in Compton and South Central through the music of N.W.A. and the movie Boys in the Hood. They were fascinated by Marcellus. They loved hearing his story of dodging bullets during a football game, but they didn't love the music he played at all hours of the night.
I had 107 noise complaints.
Only one person had ever come to his door and asked him to turn down his music. Marcellus figured the others must have been too scared to knock.
So I started to realize that, you know what? I need to find a way to kind of break down these walls between my dorm mates, my classmates, and myself and get through these stereotypes and past them.
And to do that, Marcellus fell back on something he had learned in eighth grade, in typing class.
We were using old-fashioned typewriters.
At first, Marcellus was just keeping up with other kids in the class. 15 words a minute, then 20, then 25. Then one day, when Marcellus was in the car with his mom, he started visualizing the keyboard in his mind and typing out the names of the streets as they drove past.
I would type out Slauson. I would type out Edgemar, I would type out Crenshaw, La Brea. And then I started to just type out everything I saw. 2 weeks later in class, everyone's around 35 words per minute, and I was at 45, 50. Then you look up again another few weeks, and I'm at 60, 70. Next thing you know, I was entered into some contest. I didn't know what it was. It turned out it was the National Typewriting Championship.
The competition was held somewhere in the valley, an hour or so north of L.A.
Wasn't too nervous. I wasn't really geared up for it. I didn't know how to get pumped up for a typing championship. Like, I had been in a football championship before at that age and a track championship, but a typing championship, I was like, whatever.
Everyone was given the same document to type. It was a letter.
So they said, go. And all you hear is, yeah, 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 zing. Yeah, 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 zing.
After 1 minute, the pages were collected. Marcellus waited while judges counted the number of words typed and deducted points for every error.
National typewriting champion, Marcellus Wiley. What? And I typed 82 words a minute in the eighth grade with only one error. It was amazing.
So back at Columbia University sophomore year, Marcellus was looking for something that would help him connect with his classmates, something that would help them see him as something more than a black football player from the hood when...
They hear me on the keyboard one day, they're like, whoa, Marcellus, you could type? And I was like, yeah, I could type.
Marcellus offered to type up a paper his dorm mate had handwritten.
He's like, dude, that's love, man, thank you. And he gave me like $5.
Soon, Marcellus was typing up notes and term papers for other students in the dorm, $5 a pop.
Nothing to them, nothing to me. Next thing you know, people were knocking on my door casually, not just for a paper to be typed up with $5 in hand, but just, what you listening to, Marcellus? What you up to, Marcellus? How was last week's game? And it really broke down a lot of barriers just using that skill.
Marcellus figured his odds of going pro out of the Ivy League were about the same as winning the Powerball. And during his junior season, he struggled to adjust to a new position on the field, and he wasn't on track to graduate on time. So Marcellus went back to LA for a year. He took classes at a community college and hit the gym. Marcellus Wiley had come to Columbia as a 6'1", 180-pound kick returner and running back. He returned for his senior season as a 6'4", 260-pound defensive end, focused on two things.
Graduate and make the NFL.
The first big test, at least as far as football was concerned, came during Columbia's preseason scrimmage with Dartmouth.
They had an offensive tackle by the name of Brian Larson. And he was a first to third round projected draft pick, and everyone knew it.
Before the scrimmage, the two teams lined up for drills, which meant Marcellus would go one-on-one against Larson.
Now I was like, oh, God. And I remember that first play I went at it, and I ran right around him like he didn't even move. And I was like, whoa. And everybody was like, oh, my God, what?
Later, as he was walking off the field, Marcellus was approached by an older black man in an Arizona Cardinals hat.
And he said, Marcellus. I said, yes. And he's like, just want to introduce myself to you. My name is Bird. Yeah, I'm a scout for the Arizona Cardinals. And my heart just dropped. I'm like, what? And he was like, I saw what you did here today. He's like, trust me, I'm going to tell everybody about it. And I have a big mouth. And I was like, okay. Shook his hand. Never heard from him again in my life. Haven't seen him anywhere in my life since that moment. But he did have a big mouth, because the next week at practice, scout, next week at the game, scouts, GMs, head coaches, Bill Parcells at my games. It was just from the top down, everyone was checking out the guy at that little football program called Columbia.
Marcellus Wiley's senior year has been described as one of the finest seasons ever by a Columbia football player. The team that had so recently lost 44 in a row posted an 8-2 record. On April 19, 1997, when he was selected in the NFL draft by the Buffalo Bills, Marcellus Wiley was in his family's 1.5-bedroom home in South Central LA, surrounded by his parents, sister, friends, and a television crew from CNN. What did that moment mean to you and your family?
It meant so many things, but I think in short, it meant, wow, we actually achieved one of our dreams. And it was very few things that we could point at in our world, in our life, that was actually a dream realized. My mother didn't wake up, say she wanted to be a postal employee. It just gave our entire family esteem. Like, we actually did it. We actually materialized something that we wanted.
Life changed, not just for Marcellus and his sister and his parents, but also for his children and the children that they'll someday have. It's that generational wealth that Marcellus learned about while watching Different Strokes back in the 80s.
You're going to go to the best schools, the finest colleges.
Only Marcellus's kids?
They don't have to make it in the NFL. They can just be whatever they desire and life will be good.
And you better believe, when Marcellus Vernon Wiley bought his first home in Buffalo,
I made sure I got me a townhouse at the time that had a circular staircase.
Marcellus Wiley went on to play 10 seasons in the NFL and work for 11 years as a broadcaster for ESPN before moving to Fox Sports last fall. His new book is called Never Shut Up: The Life, Opinions, and Unexpected Adventures of an NFL Outlier. English soccer player Kevin Ellison wasn't happy when his son told him about his ratings in the new FIFA video game.
He says I'm rubbish because my pace isn't up to scratch.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
Think of Life Kit as that friend who always has the best tips about everything. How to invest your money, how to get in a good workout, and much more. Life Kit, tools to help you get it together. Check it out in Apple Podcasts or at npr.org/lifekit.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know.
Naaman making the tackle, and
big hit.
Boy, Hill collapsing.
Mississippi State running back Kylan Hill took a hard hit to the head in Tuesday's Outback Bowl, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by The Athletic's Michael Lee and the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
Thanks, Karen. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Kylan Hill took a helmet-to-helmet hit in the Outback Bowl, which is a second-tier bowl for third-place teams. He struggled to get up, staggered a bit on his way to the sidelines, then his body went limp, he was helped to the ground, and because nobody ever learns anything, the team put him back in the game for the final play. The team claims that he was just, quote, woozy, that he never lost consciousness. Fine. Here's our best science on concussions. First of all, it is incredibly dangerous to play a contact sport with a concussion. Also, you don't have to lose consciousness to have a concussion. And in fact, even subconcussive hits, hits that don't actually cause concussions, can cause lifelong, non-treatable brain injuries. We make ourselves feel better about the free labor that student athletes provide by claiming that we're giving them a free education in return. But what use is that if we don't also protect their brains? Nora?
I completely agree with you, Karen. I believe the NCAA's concussion protocol is not quite actually as involved in terms of having independent doctors evaluating what might be a concussion symptom on the sidelines as the NFL's is. But in both cases, I think what's really important is for the framework to be such that if something even looks like it probably could be a concussion, you don't have to have someone forgetting where they are or, you know, not passing through the protocol. Sometimes just the act of a hit to the head should be a symptom of a concussion or a sign that someone might have a concussion. So I would like to see teams sort of adopt that philosophy that just taking the blow in and of itself is enough of a concussion factor to just play it on the safe side.
It was a meaningless bowl game. Like, it was a game that didn't matter. I mean, not that it matters, you know, the scale of the game or the importance. I mean, the player's health should come, even if it was a national championship game. But no one's going to hang a banner over winning the Outback Bowl. The moment you saw the first sign of trouble, you just sit him and then just let it end.
Yeah. And, you know, just kind of coincidentally, the Washington Post had a piece out this week about how the CEO of the Outback Bowl is paid more than $1 million a year. And meanwhile, for putting his brain on the line, Kylan Hill received $550 in gifts. Again, I know there are no easy solutions to this, but we need to do better. Michael, you're up.
Well, for years, WNBA players have fought for fair compensation from their league. WNBA players are sort of really restricted in how much money they can earn on the court. But now, this week, Christy Tolliver, a guard for the Washington Mystics, she brought to light a new dilemma for WNBA players in that they're not only restricted on the court, but if they try to pursue things such as being an NBA assistant, their salary is capped as well. She's paid just $10,000 because the Mystics and the Washington Wizards are both under the same umbrella. Their players can only receive a $50,000 pool. Now, most of that money goes to their biggest star, Elena Delladon, which means that she only gets what's left. This really brought to light a really silly rule that the players agreed to in the last CBA. Players should not be paid like an intern. They should be paid as any other assistant, especially when they put in the work. The WNBA really isn't treating its players fairly.
Yeah, and we should mention that that story was broken by Howard Magdal for the New York Times. Nora, what do you think?
I just think it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I know it goes back to the CBA, but I think if we look bigger picture, we see all these things in sports where commissioners and the people who run these leagues can find ways to make exceptions for things when they want to. And the fact that Christy Tolliver is earning $10,000 as an NBA assistant coach, that should be an embarrassment. That should be something that they find a way to fix, because it's just absurd.
Yeah, I really wonder what the WNBA's long game is here. I mean, they are actually about to enter into these negotiations, and this was their chance to show that they are reasonable partners in all of this. And instead, they come out looking like they're standing in the way of equality for women, which is not a good look, but it's especially not a good look for a women's sports league. I mean, this is somewhat ridiculous. You know, in every CBA negotiation, the players claim that they're not paid enough, and the league claims that teams are losing money. That's the script. And I'm really worried about that script playing out in this case, because it's going to make the WNBA look bad as a product. And the WNBA is not a bad product. It's a good product, right? And they were just starting to show people, we are putting on a good show. Our fans love us. We are growing and thriving. Former WNBA president Lisa Borders said regular season viewership increased 31% in 2018. So I don't know what the long game is here. Michael, do you have any idea?
Well, I just felt like some rules you don't have to just stick to. And I think in this situation, if the team, the NBA team, wants to hire her as an assistant, then you should take a step back and say, okay, well, she's being viewed as an NBA assistant, not as a WNBA player. Having the opportunity for women to become assistants in the NBA, I think that's something that should be admired and should be encouraged. And this was their opportunity to do that without, you know, holding on to some stupid CBA rule.
Nora, your turn.
We're going to go to Pittsburgh, and I want us to just kind of meditate on what to me is one of the strangest sports news cycles in recent memory. It has to do with Steelers wide receiver Antonio Brown, who skipped town before the team's last game of the season. He didn't show up for a walkthrough the Saturday before the game, then had his agent call his coach, Mike Tomlin, to say that he was going to play and able to play. Tomlin said no dice. He shows up for the game, but then leaves, severs contact again. On Wednesday, AB shows up in an Instagram video with former Steelers teammate James Harrison, and they're talking about how they're going to do this big exclusive interview about what happened.
We're going to drop the exclusive. I got it first right here on my boy.
That, at least as of now, has not happened. Then Wednesday evening, Brown shows up on a Fox reality show called The Masked Singer. Now, this was taped in June, but it happens the exact same day that all of this is going down. The Masked Singer is this incredibly bizarre conceptual singing competition show where celebrities disguise themselves and sing for a panel that includes, like, one of the guys from The Hangover's in it. It's weird. Antonio Brown's disguised as a hippo. He's pretty good.
He's horrible.
You think that's good?
I don't know. I just like that song. It's My Prerogative by Bobby Brown, which is a little bit of an ironic
Bobby Brown play,
song.
Not Antonio Brown.
So all of a sudden, everyone's going, holy smokes, that's Antonio Brown, who's in the middle of this weird drama with the Steelers. So where this leaves us is that the Steelers, they have to figure out what to do. It would be incredibly expensive and difficult to move on from Brown. And I'm curious to hear what you guys think in terms of how it'll play out. But I really also just want us to appreciate how insane this all was. So, Karen, I'll go to you first, but are you processing?
Oh, wow. Wow. You know, I go both ways on this. Like, on the one hand, I laugh at some of the ridiculousness that's gone down, right? And on the other hand, all of it kind of makes me a bit uncomfortable. There's just something about the way that punishment is handed out in sports that feels like putting a toddler into timeout. And in youth sports, it totally makes sense to me. Like if a kid is acting out and you sit him on the bench and you say, think about what you've done, that might work for a 5, 10, 15-year-old. But Antonio Brown is 30 and he's being treated like a child and he's acting like a child. And I'm not really quite sure it matters which came first, you know? So I'm left kind of made uncomfortable every time this comes up. And then it doesn't help that it generally comes up in storylines that have black men at the center of them. And then it's playing into all sorts of other stereotypes. Am I reading too much into this, Michael?
No, I think there are a lot of layers to this, and I think that the silliness is captured in a hippo head. I think that says a lot. but also, one of the things that I think it shows a lot of the issues that are going on in Pittsburgh right now, because they played an entire season without their top running back. You know, Le'Veon Bell sat out the entire year in a holdout, a contract dispute, and you got to wonder, just in terms of leadership, how they can rein things back in. And I think one of the first moves they may have to do is to part ways with Antonio Brown.
I think you're right, Karen, in saying that it doesn't always matter kind of who starts it.
Yeah.
Because when the culture has this weird relationship with punishment and with what's accepted and what isn't, it always comes to a head eventually. So not to be a downer, but I just don't see how this works out in a positive way for anyone. But I hope there's more, you know, reality singing competitions involved in
oh,
it.
Oh, man.
A hippo head, you can't lose with that.
You really can't.
I mean, the thing is, Antonio Brown is an incredible dancer, and, you know, he proved it with his end zone celebration.
Right.
So. He's a natural performer. I wish he knew the lyrics of My Prerogative. I could have liked that performance a little better.
He's no match for the peacock, who was his competition. Smart Money says that's Donny Osmond. So, you know, who can compete with that?
Trying to explain the concept of this show on the radio is one of the most difficult things I've ever attempted to do.
My guest for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Athletic's Michael Lee. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. And the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati. Thank you, Nora.
Absolutely, Karen.
Since a certain public radio host retired, you may feel like there's been a dearth of soccer content on your radio. Well, with our last two stories this week, we're going to try to fix that. Both stories are set in England, not in the Premier League, but in one of the country's lower tiers, the English Football League 2. Up first, here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
All right, I am in the studio. Kevin, can you hear me?
Yes, is that Martin?
That's Kevin Ellison, a 39-year-old midfielder on a fourth-tier soccer club in England called Morecambe FC. And you guys are known as the Shrimps?
The Shrimps, that's correct.
And why is that?
I think it's because it's a seaside resort, obviously, where the football club's based.
Okay.
Not a stone throw from the football ground, the soccer ground, as you would say. A stone from there is a beach.
At 39, Kevin Ellison's a little old for a pro athlete. But he says he still feels fit, he still loves the sport, life is pretty good. At least it was, until Kevin's 13-year-old son recently brought some unfortunate news to his attention. First thing you need to know about Kevin's son, he, like millions of others around the world, is obsessed with the soccer video game FIFA.
There's a dangerous feel to this attack, it's looking good from their point of view.
He doesn't want to go out the house, everything's FIFA, FIFA, FIFA. Do you want to come for tea? No, can I play FIFA? You're going to bed now? No, I'm playing FIFA one last game.
For the misfortunate few who have never experienced FIFA, a quick primer. In the game, you play as real professional teams and players, controlling their dribbling, passing, and shooting on the screen. Most people choose to play with the top clubs in the world, like Barcelona and Real Madrid. But the game also includes lower-tier teams, like Kevin Ellison's Morecambe FC. In September, on the day the latest edition of the game, FIFA 19, came out, Kevin's son got a copy.
Went on it straight away, and instead of going to the Messis, the Ronaldos of the world, he's gone to Kevin Ellison, who's his dad, and checks my game card.
The gamer card lists a player's stats in the game, how highly the game designers rate them in things like shooting, defending, passing, and most significantly for this story, pace.
Burst out laughing, said, "Dad, at least your pace is good." And I was like, "Why, what's that, mate?"
Kevin had been given a pace rating of 35.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's out of 99.
Yeah, I think it's 1 to 99, 99 being the quickest and 1 being the slowest. But yeah, there's me, and they give me 35.
Now, Kevin isn't the very lowest rated player in the game. That honor goes to Aaron Hughes from Heart of Midlothian in the Scottish Premiership. He's got a 24. But a 35 rating is definitely horrible. Kevin Sun puts it this way.
He says I'm rubbish because my pace isn't up to scratch.
Morecambe's next lowest midfielder was rated 26 points higher.
I think it's a bit unfair. I think there's a bit of ageism there where they've gone against me and because I'm nearly 40.
Now, there is a history of professional athletes grumbling about their video game ratings. Some fire off disappointed tweets or, like Liverpool's Daniel Sturridge, jokingly complain.
It's a disrespect to my credibility. It's a disrespect to my integrity, to my name.
But Kevin Ellison and Morecambe FC's social media guy, Matt Rushton, decided to take it a step further.
We wear GPS monitors every day in training to tell us how fast we're running, the coverage, the kilometres we run. We get the scores put up daily. So we thought it'd be interesting to get the data and show a few people on social media that 35 pace isn't for real.
Kevin wanted to show how he really stacked up against his younger teammates, who have never exactly been supportive.
They call me a dinosaur and I'm an old man. I should be finished. I should be in a nursing home, resting up and that.
But the GPS monitors showed that Kevin's top speed, at least on one particular day, was higher than most of his teammates.
The data doesn't lie. I'm quicker than them and obviously my legs haven't gone yet.
Kevin Ellison went public.
Proof in the pudding here, I've got our GPS monitors which we wear every training session and every.
He and Matt made a video. For some reason, it opens with Kevin in a bubble bath.
I don't know, he just thought it'd be funny, like an older man in the bath just chilling.
But then it shows Kevin pointing out the results from the GPS monitors to his allegedly faster teammates.
Just point to me where you are on there. So you're down there and I'm up here, yeah?
In the month and a half the video has been online, it's been viewed nearly 1.5 million times. Kevin says people have even sent him videos of themselves using his character in the game.
Videos with me still scoring against the likes of the Real Madrids, the Man Uniteds of the world and the Barcelonas. And there's me with 35 pace running past Messi and putting it in the top corner, which I quite find amusing, obviously.
Have you heard from anyone at EA Sports?
No, it's funny you say that because my little boy came home from school yesterday and he's gave me a number. He's asking me to ring EA Sports and FIFA now to try and up my pace because he's not happy and he's been getting a bit of stick, which is a bit of banter and a bit of name calling in school because his dad's only 35 pace. But no, as I say, I've not heard of them. I don't expect to.
It only seems right, though, that you've gone through all this trouble and you've proved with the data that you deserve a higher speed. I feel like FIFA should, you know, EA Sports.
Is there any chance you can help me in that then, man?
I'll see what I can do. Alas, I haven't yet been able to speak with the good people at EA Sports about whether there's any hope for Kevin's pace rating. Needless to say, we'll keep you updated in the coming weeks. But at the very least, Kevin Ellison, who turns 40 in February, wants to be back on the pitch next season. So when it comes time for Kevin's son to pick up a copy of FIFA 20, maybe EA Sports can do right by the Shrimps midfielder from Morecambe FC.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. We'll have a link to Kevin Ellison's video at onlyagame.org. Forest Green Rovers are the first vegan sports team in the world. Sometimes their fans get ribbed by supporters of other teams.
If you had some more meat pies, then you might win more games, that sort of thing, you know.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. Coming up next week on Only a Game, NFL Hall of Famer John Riggins and his wife on their fight for pension parity for pre-1993 NFL retirees. But now I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Are you ready for Alabama-Clemson in the national championship game on Monday? I mean, two powerhouse teams that absolutely never meet on the field, certainly not in a national championship. Oh, wait, that's not right, right?
No, see, I was going to say, I'm as ready as I have been the last four times they played. Hey, you know, there's nothing you can do. These are two programs that are just better than everybody else right now.
Yeah, well, as you say, Alabama and Clemson have met for the national championship game 3 out of the last 4 years. They met in the semis last year. And in their history, the two teams have met a total of 18 times. Alabama has won 14 of those games, which means I'm rooting for Clemson.
Well, your attachment to Clemson is well known. I'm glad you found a team to root for. You're rooting for the team that's going to lose the game, however.
All right. Well, there's a rumor going around that if Bama wins, DJ Durkin, who's been acting as a consultant, will be redeemed. Durkin, as you recall, was recently fired from Maryland, where he oversaw what I am going to keep calling a toxic program, resulting in the death of a player. I don't know about you, but I don't think a championship equals redemption.
No, I don't either. And I think we ought to stop writing these narratives. A guy died at Maryland, okay? And he didn't die that long ago. This didn't happen in the 1950s. This is a guy who, as you said, ran a toxic program at Maryland. I don't care that he's going to be working on the staff of the team that wins the national championship. He simply shouldn't be allowed to work with young athletes ever again, any more than Larry Nassar should.
Meanwhile, Urban Meyer got the retirement send-off he wanted when his Ohio State Buckeyes beat Washington in the Rose Bowl. But given the fact that Meyer was suspended for the first 3 games of the season for basically ignoring domestic violence complaints against his assistant coach, is this the send-off he deserves?
No, of course not, and it was embarrassing. And I'm not entirely sure that we've seen the last of Urban Meyer on a sideline either. I mean, we've been through this fandango with him before. He sounds a lot more serious than he did the last time, but I would not make the odds any better than 50-50 that we don't see him coaching another program.
Well, we do know what his plans are for next year. He'll stay on at Ohio State as an assistant AD, and he'll co-teach a class called Leadership and Character. And I gotta wonder if he's going to use himself as a case study.
Sometimes America's universities really don't have their eye on the ball, do they?
One last bowl story, Charlie. Did you see the dust-up between Ugga the Bulldog and Bevo the Longhorn Steer at the Sugar Bowl?
Yes, I did, and I think it was pretty funny video, and I'm glad nobody got hurt. This is a very large, very hostile animal, and I'm not talking about Ugga. Bevo weighs 1,700 pounds. He can do real damage if he wants to. Somebody fell down on the job of controlling Bevo. That's fairly obvious.
For the second year in a row, Washington Capitals star Alex Ovechkin was named a captain in the NHL All-Star Game. And for the second time in his career, he's skipping it. Good decision?
You know, I really love the way Alex Ovechkin plays hockey. More than anybody since Bobby Orr, I enjoy watching him play. But show up.
Well, Ovechkin will likely be suspended for 1 game for his decision. He says,
oh, good. So he gets a longer vacation.
Right. He says he needs to rest and he'll get to rest even longer. The same thing happened when he was sat out in 2016. What does it say to fans when a league has to suspend players for not playing in an All-Star game and they sit out anyway?
It means maybe that your league shouldn't have an All-Star game. I mean, the NHL All-Star game is a strange event. Nobody plays real hockey. I mean, it's even less of the actual sport than the Pro Bowl is. I mean, I remember 1 year, Boston Bruins forward Terry O'Reilly played in the game, and he threw a body check, and everybody in hockey world was horrified because you don't throw body checks in the All-Star game.
Charlie, Austin Mason and Bryson Luna are identical triplets who play basketball for Dora High School in Missouri. Austin is apparently not so good at those free throws, but it's recently come to the attention of his opponents that when he's fouled, one of his brothers sometimes steps up to the line. Isn't this the kind of thing those numbers on the backs of jerseys are supposed to prevent?
Yeah, I think that the referees have to be instructed as to why those numbers are there. But I have to admit, I know I'm supposed to tut-tut this. I give the coach at Dora High School enormous credit for
this. Well, he's their father.
He's got. The guy is presented with a unique advantage, and he uses it.
And finally, Charlie, I'd like to return us to the story of Riley Morrison, the 9-year-old who wrote a letter to Steph Curry complaining that his sneakers were only available in the boys' section. So what did Santa Steph leave for young Riley under the Christmas tree?
She got 2 pairs of the Curry 6 shoes. Steph Curry went out of his way to continue to, you know, answer Riley's quite logical question.
Yeah, well, the Curry 6s didn't even come out till this week, so she got them ahead of everyone else, which I'm hoping inspires a whole lot of kids out there to work on their letter writing skills.
Absolutely. Their handwriting, too, because I became hopeless in handwriting years ago. But there's no reason why youngsters shouldn't be able to.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce from time to time at Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week here on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
The menu at sporting events has traditionally been a bit limited and unhealthy, especially at soccer games in England.
On a match day, you're looking at a lot of sausages, burgers, bacon sandwiches, quick and easy fried food.
That's Reuben Reed, a striker with Forest Green Rovers. His team is broadening its menu with healthier fare, but that's just one part of a much larger mission. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
In 2010, Forest Green Rovers, then a fifth-tier football club in Nailsworth, England, was in financial trouble. Dale Vince, who loved the sport as a kid, was approached by the team.
They said they needed a little bit of help to get through the summer, and I thought it would be a nice thing to do, because we could, so we should. But within a couple of months, it was clear that they needed much more than just a little bit of money. And they said to me, "You really need to be the chairman." And I said, "I really don't. I've got so much else to do." But I then faced the choice. If I walked away, they would fold.
It was heady stuff for a guy who two decades before was living a hermit's life on a hill in England's bucolic Cotswolds region.
I had an old US Air Force radar trailer that I rescued from a scrapyard and converted into a home.
In 1991, he was traveling in Cornwall, and something caught his eye.
It was England's first modern proper wind farm. I was super impressed by these big machines because I was using little windmills to power my trailer and batteries from a scrapyard and stuff, you know, my kind of off-grid life, and I was very impressed.
That inspired him to build his own windmill farm, beginning in 1996. He called his new company Ecotricity. It was a big risk.
When I got started, renewable energy powered about 2% of Britain. Last year it was 30%, and we've grown to be a company of about 700 people, supplying about 200,000 customers.
Vince also created an electric car charging network and other green energy initiatives. His current net worth is estimated at over £100 million. He used some of that to buy Forest Green Rovers in 2010.
I saw the opportunity to use football as a new channel to speak to a new audience of people about sustainability. It's still a football club, but it's become something else as well.
That transformation began when Vince noticed the way Forest Green Rovers players and fans were eating.
Conventionally, and actually conventionally for football, which is even worse than normal conventional, if you know what I mean.
Vince was a vegan before he was a businessman. When he attended his first Forest Green Rovers practice as team chairman, the chef served beef lasagna to the players.
And I was a bit shocked, actually, because it meant suddenly I was part of the meat trade. And I said to the chef, "Can we stop that?" And he said, "Yeah, absolutely." Manager agreed, and we all just right there and then said, "That's it." We cut red meat out of the menu straight away for the players. We did it across the whole ground at the same time, so staff and fans and visitors as well. And then we took a series of other steps over the next couple of years towards full-on veganism.
The team dropped all meat, fish, and dairy. By 2015, Dale Vince was the chairman of the world's first vegan sports team.
There were people at the time that said, "You're going to kill the club, nobody's going to eat here," you know, this kind of stuff.
And what about the players? Wasn't veganism a tough sell to a bunch of rough, tough football blokes?
No, we never had any trouble. There all is for it. We've got several players at the club that have gone vegan completely, but several have taken that home with them and they've taken themselves and their families vegan.
One of the most enthusiastic was striker Reuben Reed, who joined the team about a year ago.
I was struggling, really bad mood swings, you know, loss of energy, rapid weight loss. I would train hard or play a game and then wake up the next day and I wouldn't be able to sort of run.
The 30-year-old Reed took to veganism almost immediately.
I can train, I can play on the weekend, and on Monday morning, I can train again and just carry on training and training without feeling any aches or pains.
And he's fired in towards goal and lips in. Reuben Reed's effort finds itself nestled in the back of the net.
So I've got a lot more stamina, and my recovery time has improved, like, times five.
Reed is fully vegan now, and his boss is pleased. Are you aware of what your players are eating on their own time, and do you care?
I do and I don't care. This is always a question that comes up. Is it in their contracts? Do they have to be vegan? The answer is no.
But if they do choose veganism, Reed says they have lots of options.
You can still have your curries, but they'll be like more bean-based, chickpea-based, and just your general greens and veg, really. You know, sometimes you get meat substitutes. The list is endless.
One of those meat substitutes, a product called quorn, is the main ingredient of Forest Green Rovers' signature dish at home games, the Q pie.
It is very tasty. If you ate it with your eyes shut, you wouldn't believe it still hasn't got meat in it.
It seems so improbable, I think, to most people that a football club could either be vegan and or be putting on great food.
Salads, pizzas, lots of curries. That's a very popular thing with vegan food.
That's Barnaby Beer. He's been a Forest Green Rovers fan for about 5 years. He's among the growing ranks of matchgoers, suspicious about what's in the meat pies at other venues.
Allegedly steak, like beef steak.
At first, Beer was happy to occasionally sample the vegan fare at FGR home games. Then he learned that former Forest Green player Dale Bennett had gone 100% vegan.
And I'd always admired him as a player. He was very, very powerful on the pitch, great sprint performance and very, very strong on the ball. And so I thought, well, if he can go vegan and not jeopardize how he makes his living playing football, then it's an okay thing to do. And I should be okay doing it just as a sort of average guy.
Beer went fully vegan about a year ago. He says he's about 30 pounds lighter now and that he has more energy and doesn't get sick as often. His sons dabble in veganism at FGR home games.
They do nuggets. They look like kind of chicken nuggets like you get at a McDonald's, but they're made of corn. The kids love them. I mean, both my boys, especially the younger one, he genuinely thought he was eating chicken nuggets for a whole season, and he couldn't understand why it was a vegan club and he could still buy chicken nuggets.
I would say food sales have probably increased fourfold since we began.
The team also collects rainwater for use around its stadium, fittingly called New Lawn, fittingly located on another way. Stadium kitchens recycle cooking oil into biofuel. The soccer pitch is mowed by a solar-powered GPS-guided robot. In July of 2018, the United Nations recognized these efforts by certifying Forest Green Rovers as the first carbon-neutral football club. But Dale Vince wants to take things even further.
We've got plans for a new ground, a new stadium, and a chance to really push the envelope of sustainable development at this new location. So we're really just getting started.
Still, there are some detractors. Reuben Reed.
I think we get a lot of stick, really. You hear whispers and you hear that because it's a smallish club and we're just making our way in the Football League and we're trying to do things different. I think people might think we're attention-seeking. I just think that's for narrow-minded people, really.
Barnaby Beer hears from them too.
You do get a bit of ribbing from other clubs about things like no meat pies at the games. If you had some more meat pies, then you might win more games, that sort of thing, you know.
But winning hasn't been a problem. Forest Green Rovers, playing for the first time in League Two, are currently within reach of a playoff berth, and they have a chance to make the leap to the next tier.
Where we'll have a bigger platform and a bigger reach for our work and our message.
Forest Green Rovers' success must make it tempting for Barnaby Beer and fellow fans to return the ribbing, right?
No, I don't think vegans go in for taunting very much.
That story came from Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Nico Emack and Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.